Welcome to your commercial-free, uninterrupted investment show, sponsored by the SEC-registered investment firm, Wilsey Asset Management, a fiduciary firm owned and operated by President Brent Wilsey, who has been putting clients' investment needs first for over 40 years. The Smart Investing Show has been giving unbiased financial information for over 27 years on local radio stations right here in San Diego, providing you with fundamental analysis on stocks and investments you want to know about. Now, here are your hosts, Brent and Chase Wilsey.
Well, hello and welcome to the Smart Investing Show. I'm Brent Wilsey, president of Wilsey Asset Management. We got a lot of great things to cover today. Going to be talking about, just came out this past week, the March CPI and PPI. That's inflation numbers. CPI is Consumer Price Index. PPI is Producer Price Index. We'll talk about that. Investing high and low, the psychology of investing. We'll cover that. And also to talk about the semiconductor industry and China, what is going on there. And with me is Chase. Chase, what do you got?
Well, got a lot of good companies here to look at this week as well. We're going to take a look at BP, and I'm talking about British Petroleum here. Oil has done extremely well. Energy's been off to a great start. But it looks like some of the European players have kind of been left behind a little bit. So we thought, hey, maybe let's take a look at a potential oil company here. I think energy prices could maybe hold up around these levels, which should benefit them. Also want to look at Redfin. We've talked with our real estate expert, Robert, about the National Association of Realtors kind of settlement. Thought maybe, hey, Redfin could be a benefactor from that. Let's take a closer look at those numbers. Also, Highwood Properties. You may not be familiar with that name, but that's a office REIT. We've talked a lot about potential investment in commercial properties. Wanted to pull one out for you and see maybe this is worth your time of looking at. And then lastly, too, is Guess. And I'm talking about the, I'll say I'm retailer. I didn't know anybody that uses Guess or wears Guess, but we're going to take a closer look at that, see if there's some good numbers there for those companies here.
Do you go to the mall very often?
I go to UTC a UTC? Decent amount. I'm not even sure if I've seen a Guess there.
I'm not sure if they have a Guess there. But I do see Guess in the malls there. But all right, well, we'll
I go
up
there
that.
More to eat, you know.
To Guess the store?
No. To UTC.
UTC store. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about the CPI and the inflation numbers that came out this past week. The March Consumer Price Index CPI report spooked investors and sent the likelihood of a Fed rate cut in June. Wow, all the way down to 20%, which was a sharp drop from the greater than 50% chance that was priced in before the data was released. The concern came as headline CPI was 3.5% over the last 12 months, which topped the estimate of 3.4%, and core CPI, which takes out energy and
what's the other food.
Food, thank you. Food rose 3.8% from a year ago, compared with the estimate of 3.7%. Now, last month, the annual rate for headline CPI was 3.2%, and core CPI, it was 3.8%. Energy prices were a benefit to headline CPI over the last year or so, but with the recent increase in energy, we're beginning to see them not benefit the headline number as much, and I soon worry they will cause the headline number to top the core CPI reading.
And that's kind of how it was during, I'll say, kind of the aftermath of COVID. As energy prices spiked, you'd see headline CPI ahead of core CPI. I think we're going to revert to something similar to that. Not obviously the same magnitude when inflation was extremely hot here. But in the March report, energy was up 2.1%. But the big reason we point this out is as we lap the easy comparisons from last year, well, the annual increase could climb substantially, which would then cause the headline CPI to obviously increase as well. Wouldn't impact the core CPI, but again, the headline CPI. The other thing we point out is shelter continues to be a major weight on the numbers as the index climbed 5.7% compared to last year, and it accounted for, once again, over 60% of the climb in CPI, so a major weight there. Transportation services were also a major negative as they climbed 10.7% compared to last year. I believe this can largely be attributed to rising energy prices. Again, you're transporting goods, you're transporting people, whatever it may be, you're having to pay for the energy cost. Most likely, you're going to raise your prices to offset the cost you're paying. Just kind of a natural thought there. Also, another thing I wanted to point out here, Motor vehicle insurance continues to be a major negative as it saw an increase of 22.2% over the last year. Again, a massive, massive increase there. Now, while this report wasn't overly positive, I would like to wait and see the PCE release, which comes on April 26th, before banning the idea for a potential of 3 rate cuts this year.
And it's so important. You know, and we talk about the CPI. It is widely known, but I just don't like it as much as this PCE, because the CPI, we talked about it, the rent equivalent, we talk about this every single time. And I saw in the Wall Street Journal this past week about how housing is now the least affordable it's been since the 80s because of the increases in taxes, you know, property taxes, insurance, maintenance costs. I'm just wondering, because it's a rent equivalent, is the formula putting in all these added expenses to get to that rent equivalent, because it's very complicated how they come up with these.
Yeah, no, it's not even a formula. It's if people they're surveying are saying,
yeah,
that's what it is. But are people factoring all those costs in, which I assume they would? So maybe that is having an impact on it. But I mean, I look at it too, and you know, I was watching CNBC the other day, and you know, Jim Cramer was kind of surprised. He was pretty strong against the CPI, kind of with his distrust in it, I'd say. Mm-hmm. And the thing he was pointing out was he was talking about apparel, and he's like, apparel prices were up. I don't get it. Like, more people are shopping on Amazon. There's a lot more people, now right or wrong, shopping on Temu, which is that Chinese kind of online marketplace. And he's like, I just don't think that prices are growing as much as the CPI is stating. And again, this is many times like a survey-based data where I do wonder, you know, 5-10 years from now, maybe even sooner, as we continue to get more data, are we going to get away from these CPI reports? Because we actually have more of this data anyways as we've had technology advance.
And that may not be a bad thing. I've always said I like the CPI because it's a number that you compare to each month, each year, and so forth. You stay with the same number. But it seems to be it's not as real as it used to be. And the PCE is personal consumer expenditures, which is more real than talking to people about what they say things cost them. Because again, they'll pick out the most highest things, and maybe they just went to Louis Vuitton. The wife just bought a $4,000 purse, and like, oh my gosh, we're spending so much on retail.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I think you have to be consistent with. Obviously, you can't, you know, this year compare the CPI, and then next year use kind of, I'll say, that technological data that I was referencing. But I think as technology continues to improve, we should get more and more sound data,
right,
rather than some of the survey data that might not be as strong.
Yeah, and people will always pull out the worst things because they'll see the negative and not say, well, yeah, but I bought this one on sale. They'll say, oh, yeah, I spent this on that. So, I mean, the surveys, I don't like the surveys as much either.
Yeah, and I mean, the problem, too, is there's just so much data. I mean, I was reading another thing about the super core gauge, where I haven't heard this in a while, and the super core gauge excludes shelter from it. And actually, that looked pretty weak. It actually was up 4.8% year over year in March, which was the highest in 11 months. And I feel like the media stopped talking about super core because I think we were under 2% for quite a while on super core, and now that it's kind of gone back up. Oh, the super core doesn't look that good anymore.
Yes. You know? So we'll just drop it.
But I think the thing you have to understand here is the more you take out of it, now that auto insurance up 22.2%, that's a heavy increase. Now that's going to be weighted more in super core than it is on headline. So, you know, there's so much data, so much information. But the thing that I look at with this auto insurance is 22.2% is such an outlier. And a lot of this is still, I'm going to say, a hangover effect from COVID, that next year, as we get rid of that outlier, again, you should have, I'd say, most items and goods and services more in a normalized pattern, which should, again, normalize inflation more.
And, you know, Chase, I just realized I need to check what I'm paying for auto insurance because it's automatic. It comes out every month. I really don't know what I'm paying for the auto insurance. And I do know one thing my insurance company does that drives me crazy because I have 8 cars, I think I have, is that every year they automatically say I'm driving them more. They increase it by 10%. That's not true. I'm not driving them more. I mean, some of them just sit in the garage. I drive maybe 500 miles a year. They're specialty cars. But they just add that every year, and therefore they boost up the premium there. So there's things that insurance companies do to get to that 22.2% increase, which you really got to look at your policies. And I'm guilty of that myself. I've just been so busy working. I need to kind of look at saying, what are they doing here?
Yeah. So. I mean, I've actually been surprised. I feel like my policy hasn't increased that much, but I know generally it's on like a 6-month contract, so I'm curious if in a couple of months all of a sudden you're like, whoa, what the heck happened here?
And you got 3 cars, right?
Two cars.
Oh, okay. You're like
I don't
family.
Like cars as much as you do.
Yeah, no, I gotta eat cars. Why do you think I like cars?
Too many problems.
You know, you're right. One of the cars was sitting there in the garage, and the differential started leaking. I haven't driven it in 6 months, and it just started leaking, so they can be a problem. Anyways, let's move on to the March PPI. The March Producer Price Index, PPI, report looked much more favorable than the CPI. Headline PPI rose 0.2% for the month, less than the 0.3% estimate, and core PPI matched the estimate as it also rose 0.2% in the month.
On a 12-month basis, the headline PPI rose 2.1%, which, oh my gosh, was the biggest gain since April 2023. And while that may sound concerning, the inflation rate is still near the Fed's target. So I would not say it's really problematic. And again, the media likes to pull out these like, oh my gosh, it's the biggest rise in about a year, essentially. But again, 2.1%, that's very normal inflation, I would say. Core PPI rose 2.4% over the last year, which again was the highest in September. And like the headline number, I just don't believe this is problematic considering the rate is still very reasonable in relation to getting that 2% target from the Fed.
And actually, I believe the CPI came out, was it Wednesday it came out?
I think it was Wednesday, and the PPI was Thursday,
Thursday. Wednesday, market was down. Thursday, I think, was up a little bit. Friday fell again. We like that because we've been sitting on a lot of cash. I think we did a buy on Wednesday, Thursday, and also Friday, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're very patient. We wait for things to pull back, and then we invest into things.
And I got to say, too, I know we talked about the estimate for Fed rate cuts, how it fell from like 50% to 20%. I think at the beginning of this month, it was 80% chance.
Ooh, wow.
They'd cut in June. And obviously, at the beginning of the year, they thought 7 cuts. The market thought that. And we've still been kind of, I initially said, maybe we could get to 4 at the beginning of the year. Now I've really tempered that back down to saying 3, maybe 2. I mean, we'll see what happens. And I'm still, before I make any determination here, I want to see that PCE number because, as I said, I still like to look at CPI, but I think the PCE is going to be much more telling.
Yeah, and I think we want to watch that. And then also, how's the economy doing? When does the report come out? I think the quarterly report comes out, I want to say, in a few weeks on the economy. Mm-hmm. That'll be an important one. Let's talk about investing highs and lows because I love to read information from smart people like Daniel Kahneman. Gosh, I'm messing up his name. I like reading his stuff. I can't pronounce his last name. I apologize.
K-A-H-N-E-M-A-N for our listeners, just so
there
you know.
How, yeah, yeah, if you can pronounce it, please let me know.
Kahneman.
Anyways, he unfortunately passed away at age 90 on March 27th. He was a pioneer in behavioral economics, although he felt he was really a psychologist. Now, if investors would listen to his advice, the returns would probably be much higher, and their psychological well-being would be far better than it came when it came to investing. He mentions that people who lost on investment feel at least twice as much pain as the gains they feel pleasant with. He also discusses how people do not incorporate all available information, and people believe that short streaks in a random process enables them to predict what will come next.
I've talked about this a lot with people.
Yes.
When they pick Tesla and then now they think they know what they're doing and all of a sudden they pick another stock and it goes down 90%. So, you know, be careful with, again, not understanding your investing process. But also, interestingly, he points out that based on research of asking people if they want to take a risk with an 80% chance of success, most people say yes. However, if you flip-flop that around and ask if they incurred the same risk with a 20% chance of failure, they say no. How interesting. Because obviously the risk is the same, but the psychology is different. I believe this is why many people get into bad investments. Salespeople just focus on the positive side and then leave the uninspecting investor to do their own risk analysis. And I think that's how annuities are sold, frankly.
I believe you're right because they're talking about, you're going to be safe and so forth. And, the market, they talk about all the negatives on the market side, not the positives. And that's how salespeople kind of work. And if you step back and, you know, we're kind of driving in here to the studio. We were kind of talking about how a lot of professionals, we don't believe, does a lot of analysis. They just do asset allocation where we spend 10, 15, 20 hours really looking at PEG ratios, PE ratios, price to book. I mean, all these important things to understand what we're getting, looking at the financial statements, so many important things to look at. And it really helps out the psychological side, because when things go down, which they will, I don't care who you are, you're going to invest in things that will go down. You don't feel the same grief when things go down, because you understand, like, hey, this is a good business. Everybody else got it wrong. And it might take 6-12 months to turn around. But that's the difference, is you understand you have something fundamentally strong, and it could go down, but you're okay with it because you know you got something good.
And I'll tell you too, I mean, it's, again, the process that you focus on. Because I will tell you, and we've told you before, is when we invest, we still might invest in something that goes down and we lose money on it. It's a possibility. That's the reality of investing. People don't like to hear that, but that could very well happen. But the reason we still feel confident is because, I'm going to say, a majority of our time here, our process works very, very well. And I'm talking about the value investing process, looking at the fundamentals, looking at the debt to equity. But sometimes, yeah, investing is going to have its challenges. But investors, they focus and fixate on those negatives. And then, you know, let's say one out of 20 investments is bad. It's so funny. Instead of focusing on the 19 good investments, people generally fixate on the one bad investment.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's the psychology of investing. And I think this gentleman, Daniel, is so right here about how he feels more like a psychologist. Because, you know, when we talk to clients a lot of times, it is a lot of psychology, because you're trying to tell people why it's going to be okay, but it's their emotions and their psychological concern that is causing them to make mistakes.
And we'll probably talk about it probably on next week's show, but I did do a post, I put it in the newsletter, I think, for next week. I wrote it and did the research on it, about how wealthy people have a lot more in equities, and I'm not going to give the percentages, I remember them, but I'm not going to give them. They have a lot more in equities, and it's contributed to their net worth, but your people below middle class don't have very much in equities because they're afraid. And they're afraid, I always say, of the unknown. And we educate our clients. We don't do this asset allocation. Oh, what's your asset? What is your risk tolerance? We don't care what your risk tolerance is. We want to teach you why not to be afraid and why this works out well. And unfortunately, a lot of people won't spend the time to teach people about investing. And it is going to be volatile.
It just cracks me up. People say, I don't like to invest in equities. Why? We know over the long term, equities have always proven to be a great investment. Oh, I just can't do it. It's just too risky. Where are you getting this data? You know, if you do silly things with them, yeah, of course they're risky. But if you just invest in good, sound businesses, there hasn't been a period in time of history, if you invested long term, that it was bad.
And I think Warren Buffett had a saying, if you can't hold an equity for 5 years, don't buy it for 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great thing.
And that's what people.
And of course, I'm saying, if you invested in 1920 and obviously we're investing in 1929, yeah, you weren't doing well. But
Right. Again,
if you look at long term investing, equities have always been a great place to be.
And I do remember back in 1929, there were a couple of companies that actually did well. They were food companies.
Yeah.
I think one was, I want to say General Foods or something, actually did well. But the reason why the market crashed, not because of the fact that people were buying equities, it's because they did not have any rules on the options and the margin. And I think you could borrow 90% of that investment. So if you invested $10,000, you really only had to put $1,000 down. And if it dropped just 10%, you had to come up with the other amount. So it's just craziness, which we don't have any longer. But we don't like options. We don't like margin. We don't do that. We're very conservative. And we still say, if you do it properly, you can average 8, 10, maybe 12% on average per year over the longer period of time. So
absolutely.
Let's talk about, and that's a lot of psychology investing, but let's talk about the semiconductor industry. And while the semiconductor industry is likely to continue growing, I do worry about China hurting the growth of U.S. semiconductor companies. Shares of chip companies like Intel and Advanced Micro Devices fell after the Wall Street Journal reported that China is ordering the country's largest telecommunication carriers to cease use of foreign chips. This, according to the journal, Chinese officials issued the directive earlier this year for the telecom system to replace non-Chinese core processors by the year 2027. That's not that far away, really.
No, it sounds like it is, but it's like, wow, it's only 3 years.
Two and a half years.
Yeah. It's crazy. China also recently set new guidelines to remove U.S. chips from government computers and servers. The problem here is China still remains a major market for U.S. chip companies, as the country accounted for 27% of Intel's revenue in 2023, and AMD generated 15% of their sales from China. Now, data from S&P Global showed that U.S. chip giants Intel, Broadcom, Qualcomm, and Marvell Technology all generate more revenue from China compared with the U.S. The relationship here with China is definitely worth keeping an eye on if you are investing in semiconductor companies, especially since most of them now trade at lofty valuations.
And yeah, and I know that Intel got hit pretty hard. I think Qualcomm got hit pretty hard. I think AMD did as well.
Yeah.
So it was.
And I got to say, I don't have a problem with this from China. And you might be saying, what, are you crazy?
I think I know where you're going, but go ahead.
I mean, here in the U.S., we ban a lot of their chip and technology here. I'm okay with them banning something like this, but if they get upset about us banning TikTok, well, you don't let Facebook and Instagram in, you know? So I think it's, if we're going to ban something similar, I think they have every right to do this. And, you know, I don't know necessarily how to fix these problems, but I kind of get it. I see where they're coming from.
And for years, we said, well, we're a free market society. We're gonna keep free for everybody. But you can't do that if your other country is actually not letting you do stuff in their country, like what allows Facebook in there and other ones. Like, well, wait a minute. That's not fair. So therefore, if you want to ban stuff, we'll ban stuff. But again, it means that China says, okay, well, you ban TikTok. Now we're going to ban this. But, you know, and we have fortunately over the years moved away from China. We're now using, I think, Vietnam more, Cambodia, I mean, other
India.
Yeah, India is coming on pretty strong to diversify that so no one country can hold us hostage on doing what they did. And actually, they now account for, I think, only 3 or 4% of our debt, which was a big
small amount.
Before. Yeah,
but so I kind of get it, but it doesn't mean that's not a risk to the semiconductor companies.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that's the major thing there. But if you like this information and want to get more information, we do have this on our newsletter. It goes out every Friday at 5 o'clock. Other topics on that newsletter, we talk about tax refunds, AI legal issues, we talk about that, venture capital, tax brackets, world population, California politics, a lot of things on there. Sign up for the newsletter. It is free. It goes out every Friday at 5 o'clock. Go to the website, smartinvesting2000.com. That's smartinvesting2000.com. It is free. Sign up right in the middle of the page, and I think you'll enjoy it. So, again, smartinvesting2000.com. Well, I think it's time to talk financial planning. For that, let's turn to our CFP, our financial planner, Harrison Johnson. Harrison, how you doing?
I'm doing well, guys. How are you doing?
Well, good. I love this topic. I read stuff before you come on air, and I always talk about I don't like this, but you brought up a good point about to reinvest or not reinvest the dividends, and one I never thought about. So I'm going to give you the microphone.
All right. Yeah. So usually when people look at this, it's, you know, more from an investment standpoint, but this can also be looked at from a planning standpoint. And with retirement planning standpoint, it can be helpful to not reinvest dividends, especially when you have non-retirement accounts. So in a non-retirement account or a taxable account, as they're called, dividends are taxed exactly the same way, whether they are reinvested or not. In retirement, the focus shifts from accumulation to building tax-advantaged cash flow. And when a dividend is automatically invested, it repurchases the same thing it came from. On the other hand, if it's paid in cash, it will remain in that account where it can then be invested or it can be withdrawn. Therefore, when a dividend is paid in cash and, again, incurs its normal tax, that cash can be accessed without any additional tax consequences. Alternatively, when dividends are automatically reinvested, which again, still taxable, if cash flow is needed, sales will also need to take place in that account to generate the cash, which then can result in additional capital gain taxes. So in a way, you're getting taxed twice to create the same amount of cash flow. Now, from a tax perspective, as long as a dividend is held for more than 60 days within the 120-day period surrounding the ex-dividend date, it's considered a qualified dividend and then taxed at the lower long-term capital gain rate. That criteria is a little technical, but basically it means dividends from long-term holdings are taxed at the lower rate. Now, it's popular for a lot of people to automatically reinvest their dividends, but in retirement, this can force unnecessary taxation and can limit other planning opportunities like making Roth conversions.
And Harrison, that's such an important part because, again, you're trying to plan for people with a good financial plan. And for years, I've seen this happen where people reinvested back into XYZ company for 10 years. And oh my gosh, what does that do to your financial plan?
Well, you know, on the one side, you have the investing side. And if you're reinvesting dividends, a lot of people like to do that because they're in the accumulation phase. Okay, well, you know, I hear that I need to reinvest everything. I don't want to have cash sitting idly. So I'm going to reinvest and try and grow and grow and grow. And on the investing side, maybe that means you're rebuying something that's overvalued that you don't want to be buying. Maybe it's better to have that cash invested in something else. But on the planning side, again, retirement is all about cash flow. And if we're trying to create cash flow, one very simple way is just to not have dividends reinvested so you can withdraw those dividends and then you're not forced to, you know, pay extra taxes to withdraw money from IRA accounts, or you don't have to realize capital gains to raise cash. And so it's just, it's a way when you're entering retirement to not trigger any additional taxes, but start that cash flow.
And I was just saying, I don't know if you could hear me, but I when Brent said XYZ company, the famous one I always like to use is GE, because there's a blue chip that people love to reinvest those dividends and, you know, hurt you from a planning perspective, because now you're taking all that cash flow into a company essentially that went down tremendously in its stock price. So, you know, not only from a planning perspective, but an investment perspective, that's where we're coming at with the idea of reinvesting dividends, is you can become completely over-concentrated in a position that could fall and hurt your portfolio as well.
Well, I also think on the investing standpoint, you know, a lot of people look down on not having dividends reinvested, but, you know, from your guys' standpoint, you, in your portfolio, you choose not to reinvest those dividends in the same company, but that doesn't mean you're not reinvesting those dividends. You're just taking that cash and investing it in something else that's more undervalued, so, you know, a better buy. On the planning standpoint, it's helpful to have access to that extra cash. So, again, so many people out there just have their portfolio, they have their dividends reinvested, they think that's the right thing to do always, and they don't think twice about it. But, you know, it's another little kind of place to look at that, depending on where you are in your situation, it can add some value.
Yeah, that's why, again, we talk about, we like to buy things low, and you reinvest a dividend automatically. You could be buying high. Like, why do that? And people say, oh, it's so easy, but you're paying higher for a price of a company that, gee, that may be trading at 15 times earnings, and you can take that dividend by a company that's trading at 12 times earnings. So many reasons not to reinvest those dividends.
And nobody stops you from actually buying back that company. If you get that dividend and it is actually low, you could take that and buy it. So it's always nice to have the flexibility.
Exactly. Well, Harrison, thank you very much. We appreciate it. You have a great weekend, and we'll talk more next week.
All right, thanks, guys. We'll see you Monday.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. All righty, that's the first half of the Smart Investing Show. Stay with us. We got the companies coming up talking about BP, Redfin, Highland Properties, and Guess. So stay with us.
Highwood, not Highland.
Oh, sorry. Okay, Highwood, thank you. You're listening to Smart Investing Show. Stay with us. We'll be back.
You're riding high in April, shot down in May, but I know I'm going to change that tune.
All righty, welcome back to the second half of the Smart Investing Show. We're going to talk about some investing for you now. Talk about, we try to get in four companies every week, but sometimes only get three because we want to go in depth about them. We're going to start off with BP, known as British Petroleum. You know, I say that, but I don't, did they drop that British Petroleum? I think it's just BP, isn't it?
The way I see it on my Seeking Alpha is ticker symbol BP, company BP.
Yeah, I think they dropped that. That's happened to companies in the past, too. I'm trying to think who it was. But, Apple
GE?
Computers. Remember Apple Computers? Dropped the computers.
Yeah. General Electric went to GE.
Yeah, that's true. So let's talk about BP. They are an oil and gas integrated company. And we look at that because you have seen, I'm sure, you pull up to the pump and you're seeing, ooh, gas prices are going up. Now, the big question is, will they continue? I think I saw last week crude oil hit about $87 a barrel. I think the low was around 70 over the past year or so.
It's tough too because there's Brent, WTI. Yeah. I know Brent top 90.
Right, and I'm talking about West Texas Intermediate crude. Yeah, yeah, because that's kind of here. But so we thought, well, maybe it's time to kind of look at a gas company, oil and gas company, an energy company. So take a look at BP. Now, this is kind of amazing. This is an ADR, but we see institutional ownership is only 11.7%. ADR means the foreign company, but we can buy the stock here in the U.S. They do have a good P.E. ratio. You're only paying 7.7 times earnings for BP versus 9.4 for the industry. Price of sales, 0.6. That's the same as the industry. Price to book value, 1.6, above the industry at 1.3. And price to cash flow checks in at 3.6, below the industry at 4.4. They do not have a PEG ratio here because I believe it's an ADR. Looking at the growth on the earnings, well, they are down 37% year over year, but the industry of oil and gas is down 40.3%, which I think you'll see that start turning around because remember, this is a 1 year over the past year. Sales are up, sales are down 15.4%, and the industry down 10.2%. We do see a 5-year growth rate for BP. Well, based on the analysts, they're saying it's going to drop 17% over the next 5 years. The industry down 1.1%. Now, they pay a 4.3% dividend, use 32% of their earnings to pay that out. We do see in the balance sheet, got a current ratio of 1.2 versus 1.3, so there's some good liquidity there. Not worried about bankruptcy. Debt to equity is 0.9, above the industry of 0.4, but I'm okay with that. Their net profit margin, 7.3. About the same as industry at 7.7, a very good return on equity, 21.7 versus 15.1. Chase, what do we got going forward?
Yeah, so looking at the current price here for BP, it's $39.44. I see the 52-week low, $33.52, and the high, $40.84. Year-to-date, the stock's up about 11%. I said it had trailed some of its U.S. peers, and I'll say I was a little mistaken. Exxon's up about 20%. Chevron's actually only up about 6%. So BP's right in the middle there, but definitely has trailed Exxon Mobil there in terms of the year-to-date appreciation. Going forward for, again, BP, we go out to December 2025. I see estimated earnings per share of $5.45. I mean, it gives us a very attractive target sell price here of $90.47. Trades at a forward PE multiple of about 7.3 times.
And this is one that we look at, and the big difference here is that this, we've not done that much research on it. We just kind of looked at that this would be something that could be good. But my question, and if you're going to invest in it, you have to understand this, the answer to this question. How much of their business comes from Europe? Because Europe's economy has not done as well as we have here. I think Europe does lean more on other energy sources. And I think BP is kind of trying to do other non-oil-based, I think they do solar and other things. But you got to understand the answer to these questions, because why BP looks attractive, you really got to know how much business they have in the United States, which has a very strong economy, versus Europe that is not so good. And will Europe economy turn around?
That was my thing. I was going to say, that doesn't really bother me that much, because I still firmly believe, it seems like everybody's been talking about it, though, for like the last 10 years, that Europe's economy is going to turn around.
Maybe it never will.
I think it at will. Some point the economy will revert back to a decent growth rate there. But, you know, that second point you brought up, that's something I don't understand, is how much of that renewables business is part of BP, because is that profitable? Is there a path to profitability on the renewable business? Are they investing and wasting too much capital on the renewables business? And frankly, maybe they're just not very good at it. The other thing too you have to understand is in Europe, the regulations on oil companies, I believe, much more prohibitive. That might be why they don't get the same type of market multiple that maybe an Exxon gets here, because those regulations can really hurt BP. So I would say the European part doesn't concern me necessarily because of the economy that much, something I understand, but more so the regulation is a big thing to understand.
And the other thing I think you should look at as well is understand what is the company doing? Because we talked about, we like a company that maybe has a refiner, natural gas, oil. I don't believe that BP has natural gas in their portfolio.
Yeah, I'm not sure on that. Right. But yeah, I like... For the major oil players, I think it's just a much safer way to play energy, because you're right, you can benefit from gasoline, you can benefit from oil prices, maybe you'll benefit from natural gas if you have all three kind of players essentially in one integrated oil and gas company.
And one thing in the back of my mind as well is that I know that there's a lot of capacity that can still come online. They talk about fracking and so forth, how here in the U.S. it's just like there's a lot more can be done. So I think we're pushing the top limit on where oil is going to go, not much higher, I don't believe.
Here's your answer. It engages in the production of natural gas and integrated gas and power. Trading of gas. I know that people have mentioned their trading operations. That's always something that somewhat scares me a little bit.
Which one?
Trading. Because you don't know how volatile that can make the earnings from time to time. They also do have onshore and offshore wind power, hydrogen and carbon capture and storage facilities, trading and marketing of renewable and non-renewable power. So, I mean, they definitely have a lot of different areas to kind of focus on. Also, it says they're involved in convenience and retail fuel, EV charging. So, I mean, they have a lot of different businesses wrapped up into BP.
Yeah, and then, you know, you do have to look at the whole picture as far as what's going to go on with the U.S. economy, who is going to be the president coming up. I mean, there's so many factors to look at, but I think if you don't have some energy in your portfolio, you're missing the boat because they are trading at pretty attractive levels. And again, we're not talking about, oh, this is a trade. You might do well. We're saying you want to buy this company for the next 3 to 5 years, collect about a 4% dividend, and I believe they do increase a dividend every year or have in the past.
They could, yeah. I haven't looked at that.
Do we still have that? Oh, I think I changed on the next company already, but I think we used to have the dividend increase over the last 5 years. Maybe not. Do you have that or no?
I do have dividend growth here, just kind of throwing me for a loop here. Over the last 1 year, it looks like they have increased the dividend. Over the last 3 years, it looks like on average they've increased it in about 6%. So not bad.
Yeah, not a bad growth on dividend. That's one thing, too, people don't realize. That dividend growth over years can make a big difference. Well, let's talk about Redfin because, you know, real estate's pretty hot. With this new increase in interest rates, might slow down a little bit. But Redfin is in the real estate services. Now, I am disappointed here. We don't research these before we talk about them on air. We do talk about them live on air, so we can really give you our true thoughts on them. But they have short float 24.6%. Now, that tells you this really expect a lot of people are really going to think this stock is going to drop dramatically. Interest ownership 61.6%. They do not have a PE, which means no earnings for Redfin. Price of sales looks good, 0.7 versus 2. Price to book value, crazy, 261 versus 1.1 for the industry. Price to cash flow, 12 versus 11.2, and there's no PEG ratio on Redfin at all. We do see no earnings over the last year, so no numbers there. Sales are down 51.5%. The industry is up 13.7%. That's very disappointing. It seems to be that Redfin is having some trouble here in the real estate industry. They do not pay a dividend. Current ratio 1.7 versus 2.6. I'm still okay with that. Debt to equity, very strange, 23.7 versus 2. Now, perhaps Redfin, we've talked about this before in the past with franchising companies, maybe they franchise their offices. I'm just guessing there. If you're going to invest in this company, you want to know the answer to that question. Net profit margin, a negative 13.3 versus negative 5. Return equity, a negative 307. Gosh, Chase, I don't know what you're gonna have over there, but what I'm seeing, it's not looking very promising.
Yeah, so we'll start here with the current price for Redfin. Again, the ticker symbol RDFN, $5.99. I see the 52-week range. Wow, $4.26 is a low. And I say wow because the high here, $17.68. So, I mean, it's just been decimated. And I was kind of, I'll tell you, intrigued by this because with the whole settlement of the National Association of Realtors here is there's concerns over maybe fees and fee changes. My understanding is Redfin has kind of operated a little bit more on the low-cost model already, kind of offering more incentives for selling houses at a lower price, for buying at, I think they offered, I saw the CEO go on and talk about the 1% deal for buyers where they'd rebate the remaining commission to the buyers. So I thought, hey, maybe they have something here in a lower cost environment. They know how to operate. But I'll tell you, I'm disappointed because you got to December 2025, estimated earnings per share, it's a loss of 96 Ooh. Cents. So not looking good for Redfin.
And, you know, we might want to ask Robert to, in the future, look at, you know, discount brokerages versus regular brokerages because I remember with Redfin, when I sold my house, I looked at their model. This was a few years ago, so it could have been different now. But if you sold your house, you'd pay the regular sales commission, but then they'd give you to buy a new house is only 1%. So you had to do both transactions. You couldn't just, you know, buy from them or, yeah, it was kind of a little bit complicated, but, you know, we'll see if Robert can maybe give us some information on that in the future. But investment-wise, I was hoping to say, yeah, you can buy a house and collect some of those commissions back and invest in the company and get dividend. Redfin is not looking very good.
I mean, yeah, because we were kind of excited. We've been looking for a potential real estate company, so to speak, because this whole settlement agreement has just really crushed a lot of the brokerages and in terms of the public brokerages, I guess, on the stock market. But it just, if they all look like Redfin, definitely not an investable space.
and I will kind of disclose that we did look at for our own portfolio. REMAX, yes. And I was shocked. The market cap of that company was only $250 million.
Yeah, very tiny.
I mean, we can invest in it. We don't tend to.
I mean, I guess Redfin's $739 million, so it's about estimated three times the size of REMAX, but still a pretty small company.
Yeah. Unfortunately, these two, and I thought that would take advantage of the housing market going forward for the next few years, but I would not take the risk on right now either of those.
Because, I mean, in theory, it's a great potential business model that would benefit from higher real estate prices because you're getting a percentage of higher real estate prices. So, I mean, in theory, there could be something there, but got to see if they can turn that theory into profits.
Well, we'll have to see if we can have Robert maybe talk about that in a future commentary, which, by the way, I think he's waiting for. So let's talk about real estate. For that, we turn to our real estate expert, Robert Behick from Countywide Mortgage Lending. Robert, how you doing?
Great. Good morning.
Well, good morning. How you doing? Everything good? We got to talk about reverse mortgages here because I like what you say here. You can have bad credit because I think people might say, oh, I can't do that because I have bad credit. But you can have bad credit you can pay that off and you can get a monthly income based on your age. So bad credit doesn't matter with a reverse mortgage. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I have two cases I'm working on right now. One of them is in Texas, and the gentleman fell. He's had to have surgery and doesn't have all the insurance that was required to cover everything. And so now do we take money out of investments? All the questions where their home is really free and clear. And the biggest issue in Texas, they don't have a state tax.
Oh, yeah, Texas. Because you're talking Texas, yeah. Yep.
The state of Texas, they don't have a state tax, but their property taxes are enormous. That's where they get most of their funding for their other things. So, for instance, on a $500,000 house here in California, property taxes are about $500 a month. In Texas, they're $1,750 a month.
Wow. And you're saying state S-T or you're saying estate E-S-T?
I'm saying estate taxes, yep. With their property taxes, right? We're talking property taxes, homes here, guys.
Okay.
And that's the biggest issue is I'm trying to help people figure out what's the best way to cash flow their money. Working with a financial planner, and the financial planner and I have been conversing. Instead of taking monies out of their investment portfolio, we took some money out of the house. We're going to pay the doctor bills and give them a little bit of income with an FHA, a reverse mortgage.
And Robert, you hear a lot of bad talk about reverse mortgages. Can you kind of tell us what the story is there?
Absolutely. They used to be terrible.
Put it lightly, huh?
No.
They're trash. They're garbage.
Early 2000, the Fed stepped in when the mortgage debacle happened, and they said, look, most of these we want to have oversight, which is fantastic. They're an FHA. It's a government loan based on FHA lending restrictions. And so because of that, there's an insurance pool. And you do pay FHA MIP. And that's why they're a little expensive. However, you don't have any of the bozos playing any games with us. You get to go through counseling. They take about 30 days to do. But looking at all the benefits of it, they're really becoming more of a financial tool for financial planners. I'll give you, for instance, the other one I'm working on here. We're actually looking at the reverse and using money that way so that when they do sell the house, the capital gains will be covered by the payoff of the interest on the reverse mortgage.
That's nice. And I know that I've always liked the reverse mortgage concept because, I mean, we've seen especially here in California, frankly, where we always say people are house rich, cash poor, and in retirement that can create a lot of issues if you have medical expenses, things like that. where, you know, your house is your largest asset. And if you've paid it off, well, hey, you might need to tap that thing for some equity or from the equity to actually pay things down. So, I mean, I think it the theory of it definitely makes sense.
It's coming down to choices and what over the long term of what you have left at the time that you need it is the best option. That's all it is. And so it starts with a conversation.
And Robert, people that are kind of looking at this, I mean, there's certain parameters it's good for. It's like it doesn't fit everybody. I mean, one thing I'm thinking, if your children want to inherit your house, it's probably not a good thing. But these are conversations you talk about to have with them saying, does this product really fit you? You go over all these different pros and cons to it.
And I love that, Brent, because we actually want to have the kids in the conversation. Let's have everybody talk about it. This isn't something that you wake up this morning and say, let's do a reverse mortgage. No. let's have some conversations and get everybody talking about it and see if it makes sense for everybody in the family, not just the one.
Is this another tool in your toolbox that you look at depending on the situation? And that's why people talk to you saying, here's my situation. Is reverse mortgage good or not? And you had that conversation with them.
That's right.
Well, Robert, thank you very much. We appreciate it. And we'll talk more next week.
Have a great one, guys. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. Again, as Robert Behick, he is from Countywide Mortgage Lending, one of the top 100 mortgage companies in America since 2012 and serving the community for over 30 years. Give him a call, 760-443-3821. That's 760-443-3821. Visit their website. It's very easy to find that. Countywidemtg.com. Again, that's countywidemtg.com. Check it out. I think you'll learn some stuff there and maybe do something yourself financially good.
Yeah, I mean, I just got to say, I really think the reverse mortgage is something that's got such a bad rap, but for some people, it is truly the best option, and some people, it's their only option to stay in that home. And, you know, you need to create cash flow. And if you have no mortgage or anything, that's great. But if you have no cash flow, that's a problem. And that's where the reverse mortgage comes in. So, you know, if you're kind of looking at, oh my gosh, I can't afford to stay in my home, this is what that's for. So,
and I'm going to say too, don't shut it out just like, oh, I don't want to invest in stocks, it's too risky. Don't shut it out because you heard bad things. Sit down and talk to Robert about it to get the true facts to see if it fits you.
Yeah, and if you don't have issues with cash flow, you probably don't need a reverse mortgage. Right. But, you know, there's some people that need it. So, I mean, that's really where it comes into play. But I just got to say, as a reminder, Countywide Mortgage Lending is a division of Golden Empire Mortgage, Inc., NMLS number 110458. Licensed by the Department of Financial Protection and Innovation under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. Countywide Mortgage Lending is an equal housing lender and proud member of the BVB.
All right, let's move on and talk about let's talk about Highwoods. I'm going to say Highlands again, but
not Highlands. That's not a Highlands. Terrible REIT that was private that people lost money on. We had so many headaches with clients that had Highlands properties.
Not that we did.
No, not that we did. I'm sorry. People that we took over.
It was a private one, wasn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, and
yep.
They could not get out of it. So that's
we
one thing.
We would never sold that.
Never sell a private REIT. If somebody has a private REIT not publicly traded, run the other way. But let's talk about Highwoods Properties. Their symbol is HIW. They trade on the exchange here. They are in the REIT office industry. And I do want to say, you know, you want to buy, we talked about this earlier with the psychology of investing, you want to buy when things are low. And yes, we know that offices are having difficulty, but this is a time to be looking at them. So we thought Highwoods Properties could be something in your portfolio. Do your own research, but we'll go over the numbers here for you. Short of percentage float is 8.8%. Not low, but not that high. We do see that they have a PE ratio of 17.6. Now, the industry has zero, so that's a positive there. Price of sales, 3.2 versus 4.5. Price to book value, 1.1 versus 0.9. Price to cash flow is 6.8 versus 10, and PEG ratio is 4.3. They do not have one for the industry, so that's a positive for Highwood Properties. Now, we do see earnings over last year are down 9.2%, but listen to this number. The industry down 26.1%, so that's a big positive for a Highwood. We do see sales were down 0.2%. Now, the industry shows up 17.7%. That does seem to be a strange number, but that's what it shows me. We do see earnings per share growth over the next 5 years for Highwood, 8% growth over the next 5 years. This is what you should be looking when you invest in this, not the next 5 weeks, but 5 years. You do see that the industry's down 2.8%. And the other benefit you get holding this for 5 years, listen to this dividend yield, 8.2%. Now, they do currently use 143% of their earnings to pay that out, but there's a thing called FFO, funds from operations. With this is on earnings, not FFO, so you got to look at the FFO. Chase may have that number for you. Look at the balance sheet, current ratio 1.5 versus 2.3, that's okay. Debt to equity 1.3 versus 1, that's okay as well. Net profit margin comes in at 17.8%, industry a negative 25.9, and return on equity 6. We like to see that around, around 15. Chase, what do you got?
Yeah, so I got the current price here for Highwoods Properties, again, ticker symbol HIW, $24.48. See the 52-week low, $17.06, and the 52-week high was $26.20. I see the year-to-date return. It's up, gosh, it looks like about 6.6%. And one thing we talk about with commercial properties is where are they? And
oh, yes.
I'll tell you just kind of off the bat, I'm intrigued by it. I mean, it says they're primarily located in the best business districts of Atlanta, Charlotte, Dallas, Nashville, Orlando, Raleigh, North Carolina, Richmond, and Tampa. And I think a lot of those are great areas, and it says that they own, develop, acquire, lease, and manage properties in those areas. And I think there's a lot of strength there. I mean, my mother and father-in-law just moved to Charlotte, and they said the business there is just booming.
And it's funny. I mean, we know about San Francisco and New York City terrible. I was just reading this past week, St. Louis is having major problems with commercial property.
Really?
Yeah, and I was shocked to read that. It's like, yeah, people are just terrible there. So make sure your commercial property is not in St. Louis.
Yeah, I mean, wow. I'm kind of surprised by that. Especially after, you know, the Kansas City Chiefs. I know they're kind of close to Missouri there.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, they'd be booming after they won the Super Bowl. The Taylor Swift hype.
I was shocked to read it, but yeah, St. Louis is another one you want to be careful of.
Huh. Well, looking at the valuation for Highwoods Properties, want to take a look at that. Go out to December 2025. I see the estimate for FFO, again, funds from operations here, $3.53. It gives us a very attractive target sell price of $58.60. So it still trades at a forward FFO multiple of about 7x. I mean, very, very attractive valuations there, especially paired with that nice, say, juicy dividend yield.
And I'm going to ask you again for that FFO. What's that number again per share?
Per share, it's $3.53.
Okay. I bring that out because if you just look at the earnings per share, you're going to find something different. You're going to find it's only 41 cents. If you're just going on that, you're missing the boat, because keep in mind that earnings per share estimate of 41 cents, that includes depreciation. Well, we know real estate does not depreciate. I mean, over the long term, it appreciates.
Yeah.
So you've got to look at the FFO when you're looking at per share. Do you by chance can you see the book value per share of the real estate? That's another very important one to look at.
I cannot find that. Okay. Yeah, throw me on the spot here. Jeez.
I know.
You have book value on the other. You have the price of tangible book value. It's not of the real estate, but I mean.
Yeah, it's not quite. I was looking at the dollar value, because one thing you want to kind of look at, depending what the stock is trading at, and we'll just throw out numbers here, say that the stock is trading at, what is this trading at? What was the price on this?
$24.48.
Okay, so $24 is the stock price. If you looked at the book value per share of this, and you see it's $35, keep in mind that's the book value of the real estate, does not include the appreciation. So that shows you, like, wait a minute, the stock's trading at 24, but the book value is at 35. You're also another positive factor to invest in.
So I have the book value per share here.
Oh, how'd you find that?
It's just on, it says $22.75.
Oh, well, shoot, that's not what I wanted to see.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised. I mean, it's not egregious.
Right.
You know, one times, because the thing you have to understand too with book value in real estate is that's the depreciated value, not necessarily the market value of what all those properties are worth. But yeah, I have seen other ones that obviously the book value looks much more attractive than the current price, essentially.
Yeah, because I know we have a couple of REITs in our portfolio. I know one that comes to mind. It trades at more than twice, I think almost 3x the book value is what the stock's trading at. So it's a third.
It's not trading at 3x. It's trading at 1/3.
1/3, yeah. Yeah. Or the book value is 3x the current price of the stock.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and again, what's great about REITs is you get that nice dividend, that nice cash flow. Now, taxes are not taxed as good as corporations are, though.
Yeah, you don't get the dividend long-term capital gains rate. It is slightly different, but, you know, I mean, it's still a nice yield. If you look at the after-tax yield, it's still a strong yield at the end of the day for most of the REITs that you have.
And I like REITs too because it's a way to play real estate, have part of your portfolio in real estate, and you've got diversification, you've got professional management, you're not going out and buying some building or some property yourself that you really may not know what you're doing, and all of a sudden you have to file bankruptcy because you didn't know what you're doing.
Yeah, and you don't ever have to go fix the toilets. You don't have to right. take phone calls from people complaining about the rent. You don't have to handle any of the day-to-day operations of it. I will tell you the one downside is you do have to go through stock market volatility of the ups and downs, but at the end of the day, you still own real estate. That's what you own with REITs.
Right, right. And as we always say, look at your portfolio twice a year, January 1, December 31st, in between means nothing at all. Gosh, there's that closing bell already. Thank you for listening to the Smart Investing Show. It is for information purposes only and should not be used as investment advice. If you'd like to discuss in more detail your investment needs, have other investment questions, feel free to call myself, Brett Wilsey, or Chase Wilsey at 858-224-0004. Again, that's 858-224-0004. And if you miss any part of the show, you can listen by podcast. Go to our website, smartinvesting2000.com. Again, that's smartinvesting2000.com. A lot of great information there. Thanks for listening to the Smart Investing Show. We'll be back next week.
So amusing to think I did all that. And may I say,